Welcome once again, everyone, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with Will Lingo, I'm John Manuel. Thanks for the download. A little late here this week, but looking forward to talking baseball with you here for the next 15 or so minutes on the Baseball America podcast. First one for me in a while, Will, and glad to be back at it.
And now with two kids, joining the two-kid generation.
Yes, well, it's the joke I keep making, as I just made before we were on the air, is that we were playing man-to-man now instead of zone. I still like that joke, especially since it is college basketball season now. So when you only have one kid, though,
you can run like a zone press. It's when you're playing zone and you're outmanned that you're really in trouble.
Yes, that would be called the Callis defense, as Jim Callis has four children.
Or the Leventhal defense now.
The Leventhal defense. It's hard for the Leventhal kids. They're all too young to run the three-on-two break properly. The Callis kids have grown to an age where they can take advantage of the defense, it would appear.
Doing three or four, that's
brave.
That takes a strong constitution.
That's brave, and doing three or four and doing two top 30 prospects, or three top 30 prospects, and editing a prospect handbook, that's called bravery or being crazy, but both apply to Jim Callis, so we applaud Jim for that. So, but we'll talk a little baseball. We'll talk a little Project Runway, season four underway.
We have many loyal baseball fans who really enjoy us talking about Project Runway at the tail end of a podcast.
And we have some who can't stand it, so you can turn off early when we start talking about Project Runway. That's fine. You can turn the sound down. But let's talk about the headlines in baseball, though, Will. A headline-filled week here before Thanksgiving, and sometimes at this time of year, annually this time of year, baseball is giving out its awards, and maybe the close National League Rookie of the Year vote, one of the closest ever, or the closest ever between Ryan Braun and Troy Tulowitzki, that would be the biggest headline, or Jake Peavy being a unanimous Cy Young Award winner.
Jake Peavy's the guy who definitely did not get proper headlines for his achievement.
Yes, he was tertiary story yesterday. Secondary story was the largest contract in baseball history, the framework of that being agreed to between the Yankees and Alex Rodriguez. But once again, in 2007, the story in baseball is Barry Bonds. Whether you like it or you don't like it, as Ric Flair used to say, you have to learn to live with it, because it was the biggest story going today, and that's Barry Bonds being indicted for perjury by the federal government. So the Balco stuff, all the investigations, the game of shadows, all these things finally produce an indictment. In my mind, it's almost like too little too late. Where was this prior to Bonds getting the 762? But in some ways, Bonds' pursuit of Aaron and the tainted pursuit of Aaron and surpassing Aaron almost brought so much more attention to Hank Aaron. I guess if you want to look at it that way, but a generation from now, I think all the people are going to see is whatever A-Rod's record's going to be, and then Bonds and Hank Aaron being third.
Yeah, I guess the good thing is that you do figure A-Rod is going to break the record relatively soon if his career continues on its present arc. If Barry Bonds is in second place, Tom Verducci wrote very eloquently today that, you know, that number doesn't need an asterisk. It's always going to be accompanied by shame and derision. I think he used better words than that, but that's the gist of it. People don't need to attach any special designation to Barry Bonds' numbers. We all judge them that way anyway. When I was at my son's school this morning in the library, first graders in line checking out books, one of them just turned to the other one and said, "Barry Bonds is a cheater." So I think that sums it up pretty well.
Out of the mouths of babes.
Like you say, the indictment is almost sort of an anticlimax, but I do think that and the Mitchell report will hopefully tie up the loose ends on the steroid era, and we can just sort of move forward from here.
I sure hope so. Always forward, never backwards. I hope we're twirling toward a better
drug-free offensive era.
I hope so. We'll see how things play out. The Mitchell report, it's pretty funny how it went from one interpretation that, you know, got misconstrued, another 11 free agents who are on the Mitchell report, which that's just not true. Bonds, I think you make a great point to link the two. Between Bonds' little interview with Jim Gray, the indictment, I can't see how Barry Bonds' career will continue. He's a free agent. I don't see a team signing a player who's been indicted.
The Giants were the only team that had any sort of, you know, rope with their fans where the fans would tolerate Barry Bonds just because of his history in San Francisco. You know, when we were there for the All-Star game, there were fans wearing Barry Bonds jerseys. I'm sure they were as well aware as we are of what's gone on in Barry Bonds' career, but the Giants are obviously done with him. The other teams aren't going to want to get into that quagmire at all, I don't think.
So that career is probably over. 762, 762 home runs. Looks like that's the record. as Verducci wrote, and I agree with, and you agree with, not really much need for an asterisk. The guy, it speaks for itself. For this generation, obviously an asterisk is even the word. I think that you wouldn't put an asterisk, but there should be some designation in the future if he's indicted and is, you know, found in a court of law to be guilty for saying that they didn't knowingly take steroids. That's a lie. They knowingly took steroids, which I believe, and I think you believe.
Well,
and
from what I've heard, I haven't read the indictment myself, but from what I've heard, the indictment does contain documentation of a positive steroid test
at Balco.
From Balco,
right?
Which I guess would be the first sort of on the record
smoking gun,
yeah, indication that Barry Bonds has taken steroids. Now, anybody who's read any of the creditable reporting on Bonds knows that's the case already, but this is just, you know, another log to throw on the fire, I guess.
Yes, there are many of those. This is quite the blaze. This is like the fire that Tom Hanks had on the beach in Castaway. It was supposed to be a signal fire. This is a big old obvious fire with Barry Bonds. But I think that career's over, and good riddance, basically, as far as I could tell. Great hitter, fun to watch hit, just to see a guy that locked in. But you know, Manny Ramirez is pretty locked in the postseason this year too, and he squared up everything on the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Manny Ramirez is just too nuts to take steroids or performance enhancers. I don't have that whiff of suspicion about Manny Ramirez, and nor do I about Ken Griffey Jr., which I read something this week, which was pretty cool about just, you know, Ken Griffey's aging like players always used to age.
Right.
That's the greatest evidence that Ken Griffey Jr.'s clean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he got hurt like.
It's a shame that the injuries
yeah.
sort of changed his career trajectory, but yes, he's at least following his career arc the way nature intended.
Now, his former teammate, Alex Rodriguez, does not quite have – he doesn't have the there's no signal fire for him of performance-enhancing drug use. Doesn't seem to be. And
he's just raked from the time he picked up a baseball bat, pretty much.
Yes, until the playoffs, that's exactly what he's done. Until he put on Yankee pinstripes. And for whatever reason, Alex Rodriguez has decided to go put Yankee pinstripes on again. Actually, though, I believe there are 280 or so million reasons that he's done it.
I mean, I think people will theorize about this for time immemorial, trying to figure out, you know,
it doesn't seem that way on the blogosphere recently.
The opt-out and, you know, going into the market and then ending up back with the Yankees so quickly. I mean, I expected him to end up with the Yankees, frankly, but I expected it to be sort of the Scott Boras path where you go into the market, you get some numbers generating, and then you get somebody to sort of make
right.
a panic move at the end of the process
I really
in the last
thought,
minute.
I really thought there'd be a circus at the winter meetings
right.
of Alex Rodriguez being shopped around by Scott Boras, and Boras throwing out fake offers from other clubs that don't really exist. And without having to do all that, without A-Rod being 25, as he was last time he was a free agent, without any of, well, I guess 26 actually, without any of that, A-Rod got more money now than he got 7 years ago, and he was younger, played shortstop, and, you know, was entering his peak. Now I think he's past his peak. I really do.
I think he might be at his peak, but I would say I think a lot of this contract will be on the downside of his career.
He had his peak. He had a similar season to this as a shortstop 4 years ago. So to me, this is a guy who's at or passing his peak, no longer a shortstop. He's signing a 10-year contract that'll take him through the age 42, 43 season. I don't understand why he got more money than he got last time, even if the revenues of the sport are greater. That last contract was a bad contract. It wasn't just a bad contract in the context of baseball at that time, where they overpaid because other teams were $19 million. It's a bad contract in that at $25 million a year, it's almost impossible, even for the best player in baseball, to perform to that level. And if you look at his production, his teams have gotten worse in his 7 years. They got his teams in Texas were worse with him than they were without him before, and they have been since then. And the Yankees have been worse with him.
But
it's not his fault.
I think the Yankees would have been much worse without him going into next season.
I'm not convinced of that.
I just don't see where else they were going for a third baseman.
Mike Lowell's a free agent. Miguel Cabrera, obviously the price is high on Miguel Cabrera, but the price is high in terms of pitchers or pitching prospects or trade. But
I think Lowell's going back to Boston, and Alex Rodriguez is better than Mike Lowell.
He is better than Mike Lowell, but Mike Lowell has two World Series rings, and
that's
Alex Rodriguez
true.
Has none, and Mike Lowell has been a key part of those two. He's not incidental to those two championships. And Alex Rodriguez, I mean, I know this just sounds irrational, but he's The facts speak for themselves. The last 7 years, the 7 years of that giant contract, for whatever reason, he has not performed up to that contract when things matter, in the areas that matter the most.
Well, I think it's
interesting. I just don't see how teams could ignore that. I don't understand why the Yankees would ignore that.
After the Yankees got knocked out of the playoffs early, I think everybody thought there were going to be massive changes to that team. And obviously changing the manager is a huge change. But
sure.
That team's going to look a lot like it did last year, next year.
Yes, it is.
It's going to be much more expensive, even more expensive than it was last year, with Posada, Rivera, and A-Rod coming back at much higher prices.
For the market, for the rest of the industry, the Posada and potential Rivera contracts are actually worse for the industry.
Right.
If you're the Minnesota Twins, for example.
You're talking about guys even closer, even
yes,
more in the decline.
Absolutely.
If you argue that A-Rod's in a decline, those two guys are much more further along in their decline.
Jorge Posada had a fantastic 2007 year, by far the best of his career. He's 36.
He's going to be useful player by the end of that contract.
He's a 36-year-old catcher who just signed a 4-year deal. That is almost unprecedented. I think it is unprecedented, and he got a lot of money.
But, what were the Yankees going to do at catcher next year without
Pedro
him?
Pedro Santos? Yeah.
So
I don't think so.
They were in sort of a bad position, so they had to overpay for all three of those guys.
But, like, the Mariano Rivera question, that's even more vexing to me, because why pay? They can pay $15 million a year for Mariano Rivera, and it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter to them, but they could have had Jabba Chamberlain as their closer and probably be better. I know I'm almost sacrilege to say that, but Mariano Rivera is 38. That's old.
Yeah, and
that's
if you say he's pitcher. Grooming, if you say Jabba's the, you know, in what the Mariano Rivera role was when John Wetland was there, I mean, why are you paying Mariano Rivera that much to be Jabba's tutor?
Yeah, I don't quite get it. But that drives up the price for everyone else, for catchers and for closers, and that's where the iniquity in
but
the
other
game
interesting
really comes
thing
up
from a BA perspective is just it's so rare to see Scott Boras, to see a Scott Boras negotiation not go exactly to his blueprint. And I can't imagine that this was the blueprint he had laid out for the A-Rod free agency.
I don't think it was either, because I think he really believes it when he says industry revenues are triple what they were when Alex Rodriguez signed the last contract, so Alex Rodriguez is a better player now, blah, blah, blah. I think he really thought he was going to get A-Rod $300 to $350 million. It was interesting for Alan Schwartz of the New York Times, formerly of Baseball America, to write about how this mirrored, in some ways, A-Rod's draft negotiation, where A-Rod had to kind of go past his agent, Scott Boras, to get past a impasse in negotiations and make a deal happen, which
yeah,
it sounds like kind
either
of happened this year.
You can either go back to your old Baseball Americas and read about that, because Alan was the one who covered that for us when A-Rod was drafted, or you can go to the New York Times website and read sort of his synopsis of that. But it is pretty much exactly the same set of circumstances. Scott Boras was holding out for, I believe the number was $3 million. The Mariners were offering less than half of that. It was getting down to the last minute. I don't think A-Rod really wanted to play college ball at Miami. He wanted to get his pro career started, so he did sort of an end around, and Scott Boras was not involved in the final negotiations of the contract. I think Alan's story said he was, you know, contacted by phone through the process, consulted as they were, you know, drafting the final details, but he was not really part of the final negotiations, and actually later filed a grievance over the case, which was eventually dropped.
But suffice it to say, A-Rod gets more money than any other player in the history of the game has gotten, including him, and that's really with only one team negotiating.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to try to spin this as a Scott Boras loss, I don't see how you can do that, because his client got more money.
Yeah.
And for people in the media who have spun this as a Scott Boras loss, it's just not.
It's a little bit of a PR loss.
It's not how he wanted it to go, that is for sure. But his client comes out pretty good. And if you didn't know the other stuff, Scott Boras, I can see how Scott Boras has been this positive. For me, it's a push.
The
His
most
client
interesting
came out better,
question
he came out
to
worse.
Me is whether A-Rod genuinely really wanted to go back to the Yankees, and that's why he, you know, sort of took things over, or whether they got out in the market and found that the team they were looking for to be the exorbitant bidder just wasn't there, and this was sort of a fallback plan. But
I just
that's
don't
just
think,
sort of interesting from a historical perspective.
I just think the flaw in the whole thing is that I just don't think having one player who makes that much money works in Major League Baseball. Like it might work in football, where you have a quarterback who clearly can make more than everyone else because he is more important. than everyone else on the team.
Well, it works.
Or in the NBA, where one star can be
I'd say
so
it's most mitigated with the Yankees because they do have such a large payroll, but you still do have that one guy who is making a lot more money than everybody else.
He's making $7 million more dollars and with no rings than the guy who's making $20 million with four rings.
And we can never really know what kind of clubhouse atmosphere that creates. We can only know what the results have been for the Yankees, like you say, and the results speak for themselves.
They do. So it's the Baseball America podcast. He's Will Lingo. I'm John Manuel. Alex Rodriguez was once a prospect, so we probably should talk prospects. That's mostly what people tune in for us to do. I don't see any Alex Rodriguez's in the National League Central, Will. But I do see Colby Rasmus be our future cover boy.
Colby Rasmus also playing well in the World Cup.
Yes, he is.
Sort of showing. I think Colby Rasmus is a legitimate future star. And we had a lot of interesting Cardinal stuff in this issue, both in their top 10 prospects, where I think their system is on the upswing, and a feature that our Cardinals correspondent Derek Gould did along with his fellow reporter at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Joe Strauss, just writing about the rift that developed in their front office after Jeff Luhnow was hired, and as Jeff Luhnow sort of ascended in the organization and got more influence at the same time Walt Jocketty had the Major League team winning the World Series and then had his contract renewed. But
right.
There was just a huge divide between sort of the Major League camp and the minor league camp in that organization. And eventually Walt Jocketty was sort of the odd man out because they decided the situation was untenable.
That's unbelievable that the guy who has been the general manager would be the guy that you don't pick, that you pick the farm and scouting director guy as a guy you're going to keep around in Jeff Luhnow. That's just the shocking part of that to me.
Well, I think, I don't know, you can see that there's blame
right
on both sides
choice,
because
right.
as those guys write in their story, you know, a lot of people saw Luhnow's elevation as an erosion of Jocketty's power, but they say a lot of people in the organization almost say it was almost an erosion by choice because the Jocketty camp made no effort to reach out to the Luhnow camp. So see blame on both sides, but yeah, it's just an interesting story, and I think John Mozeliak actually, I don't know if he was necessarily going to be their first choice because you did have some guys drop out of that GM race, but I think he is going to end up being a great choice for them.
And it just doesn't seem like it. There need not be two camps,
right.
Is what the Cardinals front office decided, the ownership decided, and rather than having a house divided, they decided even it's more important for us to be one big,
yeah,
happy organization.
I think they had already sort of cast their lot with Luhnow to remake their farm system, so it almost would have been harder for them to start over with their scouting and player development than to start over with the new GM.
And the thing is, I think you have to say Jeff Luhnow's done a good job with their scouting and player development. Their top 10.
Yeah, their top 10 looks
probably,
pretty good.
Probably in the best shape since our 1997 top 10 that we dug out yesterday that had eight straight big leaguers at the top.
Yeah, I remember that one because Rick Ankiel had just been drafted, had not pitched in a pro game other than instructional league, and I talked with one of their I can't remember if he was one of their scouts or instructors. Anyway, somebody who had been in their instructional league camp and just talked about how he was dominant in instructional league and struck out like six or seven Reds batters in a row in his first or second start. So we ran him up to the top of the list.
Run him
up. And that panned out until he got the thing.
Yes. It did pan out.
There were also, five or six other big leaguers on that list?
The first eight guys were all big leaguers.
So,
Placido Polanco.
That was kind of the end of a long period of good production from the Cardinals farm system. And since then, they've usually had one or two guys each year who are pretty good and then a lot of guys who are questionable, and they end up trading away a lot of those guys.
Speaking of questionable, the National League Central is a pretty questionable division, period. 83 and 84 wins.
Mm-hmm.
For the division champs the last couple of years. And this crop of prospects is pretty uninspiring. I would actually venture to say that for the first time in my Baseball America tenure, the Reds have the best farm system in this division. I don't think it's close.
I liked their list a lot.
And they have the best talent
in this
division.
When you start with Jay Bruce, that's a great place to start.
You start with Jay Bruce, but you throw in Johnny Cueto and Homer Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, those are probably the two best pitchers in this whole division, aren't they? Prospect-wise?
Yeah. I mean, we would have to go through the list one by one to see for sure, but yeah.
Well, the Cubs' top pitching prospects are Jose Seda, Sean Gallagher, Donald Veal, and Jeff Samardzija. I don't think so. Those guys don't compare to Bailey and Cueto, in my opinion. The Astros, we could just zoom right past them. That's one of the worst farces in the game.
Troy Patton's good, but their system is in terrible shape.
I mean, the Brewers, Manny Parra is good. Mm-hmm. I'd take Bailey or Anquato mm-hmm. over him. The Pirates, wasteland.
That is a bad system.
I mean, I have a lot of respect for Brian Graham. I think Brian Graham is a really good farm director. I don't know Ed Creech. Ed Creech's track record is not inspiring. But collectively, I can't see a better case that can be made for an organization that needed a clean house top to bottom than Pittsburgh.
I understand why Brian Graham was upset to be fired, but I can understand change for the sake of change with the Pirates.
And the Cardinals, Chris Perez is their top pitcher, and Aviño and Jaime Garcia.
And when your ceiling's a closer, that automatically puts you behind a guy.
So the Reds haven't really developed homegrown pitchers since Mario Soto and Tom Browning, and they have the two best pitching prospects in this division. And then they have the best player in Jay Bruce. They have a polished, ready-for-the-big-leagues hitter in Joey Votto. They have toolsy guys like Drew Stubbs and Devin Mesoraco and Todd Frazier. Mm-hmm. They have relievers like Sean Watson and Josh Reneke. They have a nice lefty they picked up in Matt Maloney. They have some depth. I think that's the best farm system in the National League Central.
And then I might put the Cardinals behind them.
I might, too, because Colby Rasmus is Colby Rasmus.
So those are two sort of surprising systems that haven't been good in a while.
Absolutely.
They look like they're on the upswing.
The Cubs are maybe the weirdest top 10 in this because you got – number one prospect who went 6-for-51 this year, and Josh Vitters. I think it tells you a little bit about how we do things. We're about ceiling. Ultimately, we're about ceiling. Ceiling and chance to reach the ceiling. But when Josh Vitters gets picked third overall, we believe in that ceiling. And we believe in the Cubs' ability to draw that ceiling out, even though they have not developed a hitter who's become a good big leaguer in the last 10 years.
And that's the subject of Jim Callis' column, which is in the same issue, which I think Cubs fans and non-Cubs fans alike will find an interesting read. And
yeah, we always
anytime we can run an Earl Cunningham photo, that's always a good thing.
We like to bag on the Giants for not developing position players. The Cubs are just as bad. Mm-hmm. They've drafted and signed two who've become legit regulars in Eric Hinsky and Corey Patterson. And those are both back.
Those would be below average regulars.
Or as my 3-year-old would pronounce it, yegular. and then you've got Ryan Terrio. Who they developed. He's okay.
Mm-hmm.
In the draft, but like internationally, like maybe Gio Soto or Ronnie Cedeno turn into regulars, but Felix PA has a chance, but their track record for developing hitters is kind of sketchy. I got to be honest with you, Josh Vitters, he's an Alan Matthews fave. I'm not on that bandwagon. I don't believe in him. I believe he'll be good, but he, to me, is kind of like a Pat Burrell, where Pat Burrell was supposed to be a superstar and was the 1-1 pick in 98.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
And I believe that. I think Josh Vitters is going to be like Pat Burrell, where he's good, but you're always wanting a little more. I think he's going to be that kind of player, and I also think he'll end up in left field like Pat Burrell. You heard it here first. my money's on the Moustakas kid. But the rest of that Cubs list, I mean, Kevin Hart, he didn't make your Orioles top 30 last year, and he's in the Cubs top 10. Now, Kevin Hart's a different pitcher now than he was with the Orioles, so the Cubs improved him some. Perhaps I should give Oneri Flata a little credit for that.
Good
Cubs
development.
Farm system. Good development by the Cubs, but it's not a great farm system anymore.
No, and like you say,
the Pirates are bad, and they've had high pick after high pick after high pick, and it's a bad farm system. You got the number 6, and they're talking about utility players at the number 6 spot in their top 10.
Yeah,
it's UGLY, and it really has no alibi.
So when you're talking about the National League Central getting better, it's
not bloody likely.
It's hard to see.
It's the Brewers, where they've graduated, where all their good young players are already in the big leagues. The Brewers are the organization, in my mind, that has the highest ceiling.
But, I mean, as far as that division becoming more competitive, where you have to win 95 games to win it,
yeah, not bloody likely.
That.
No, me neither. So,
but that makes it more interesting for every team in that division. You can legitimately go into every year thinking you could win it all.
Well, let's wrap up with a couple minutes of prospect talk.
Project
Runway, exactly. Project Suspect. Project Runway talk. First show of season 4 was on the other night. Highlights. Heidi Klum still looks great.
I thought she actually looks better than she ever has.
It's pretty good for having had two kids, and she's aged gracefully. So we're big Heidi Klum fans here at Baseball America. Glad to see Tim Gunn back on the show. I would not have texted, though, when they had, what's your favorite part of Project Runway, and you text your vote, and Tim Gunn won 54% of the vote.
Wow.
He would not have won mine.
The show wouldn't be the same without him, but Yeah, I don't know if.
I'm not sure. I don't know if I can put my finger on what is my favorite part of the show, but I definitely think Heidi Klum is in the top two. So
I
we'll give her that credit.
just like the fact that the show is about what it's about. It's not, so many reality shows are just about, the silly gameness of it
Right.
or the, people freaking out or being dramatic. This show is about,
Or
it's
lesbian
supposed to be, yeah, I mean, it's
hookups.
just about silly stuff.
Yes, I'm
This
thinking.
show is supposed to be about fashion designers, and what do you know? They do fashion designing,
That's
and
right.
I couldn't care less about fashion, but
Yes, we have
just
one person in the whole office, and Sarah Hyatt, who gives a darn about fashion, and she watches the show. But you and I, and don't usually. Well, you tuck your shirt in. I don't. I'm a bit sloppier than the average Joe, but I really enjoy the show, and I think it's despite the fact that it's just true to itself. It's a very
right.
sincere show. It doesn't try to be anything that it's not. And the people who are on the show, most of the designers are not sincere, but the judges and Heidi Klum and Tim Gunn are very true to who they are, and Nina Garcia and all of them. So I enjoy the show for that
You knew
standpoint.
Nina Garcia was going to tear up the woman Simone,
Yeah, Simone
who
LaBlanc.
sort of ran out of time to properly sew up her dress. You knew Nina Garcia was going to be
So
all over
when I
that
saw that Nina was one of the judges, I was just couldn't wait for her to just
when she
tear up
said,
Simone.
could you have your model take off the jacket, please?"
Yes,
It's
that
like,
was.
all right, she's done.
I took
And the
too
show.
much pleasure in that.
And the show does have one legitimately crazy person, as every reality show has to have. What is that
I think
woman's
it's
name?
Kristen. I think it's Kristen. She's not on this little cheat sheet we have, but it's
Oh,
the
it's Elisa. That's
oh,
who
it's
it
Lisa.
is.
I'm
She
sorry,
doesn't really look like that
Elisa.
photo, but
Yeah, she's Loco in La Cabeza.
she's a marionette designer who got into fashion
That's
somehow.
right. She's straight out of being John
And
Malkovich.
the first person ever to finish early and go take a nap on Project Runway. That
And
was awesome.
also the first time that we ever heard Heidi Klum say poo.
Oh
And she
yes, it
said
looked like
that
she was
her
pooing
dress looked
fabric.
like your model is pooing fabric. So very many highlights from the first one. Write this one down, Will. Who's your pick to win? Who's your pick to click the whole thing after one
I think
episode?
the smart money would be on the guy who actually won the first
Yeah, Rami.
challenge, Rami.
Yeah, that's where my money is.
If I had to pick somebody else, I think I might go with Jack.
I don't even know who that is. Is that the straight guy or the plus size? Okay, my upset special is the plus sized gay
Yeah,
designer,
that
Chris.
guy actually did a good job.
He was also interesting to watch him, where everyone else made the mad dash for the fabric tent, and he just made the lethargic dash, which would have been the same dash I would have made. I would have made the lethargic stroll. So I'm feeling it for Chris. I feel an empathy and a connection there with the larger
But in the first episode, it's so hard for them
designer.
to focus on everybody. There are a lot of contestants who we basically learn nothing about in that episode.
Jack, I believe, is the one who gets kicked off. That's the buzz.
Oh, really?
Buzz on Jack, I believe, is he's the one who gets kicked off. He's the one with all the drama this year.
Uh-oh.
So, but last year, the guy who probably could have won was the guy who got kicked off early as well. So, but we're glad the show's back. Obviously, Will and I are interested. If you are, you can send those into us at podcast@baseballamerica.com. Our question from Phoebus Apollo, we should read it before we was basically since Ryan Braun won Rookie of the Year for us and for the National League, he asked if the Nationals had to do it again, and that year, that wonderful 2005 draft was going to go down as one of the great drafts ever. The number four pick they took Ryan Zimmerman, number five pick they took the other Ryan Braun, not Lloyd Braun, but Ryan Braun. If they had that to do over again, would they take Ryan Zimmerman or would they take Ryan Braun? I believe they actually would take Ryan Zimmerman. He was ready for the major leagues quicker, and he's a much better defender. And offensively, he's pretty good. And I don't know that Ryan Braun will repeat this kind of season. The strikeout
Yeah,
to
that's
walk
the big
ratio wasn't that
question. If
great.
Ryan Braun puts up these kinds of numbers
Then they
every
will get
year,
it.
then he's definitely the better guy.
But everyone has always known that his offensive ceiling was higher than Ryan Zimmerman's.
Right.
But I think they were looking for a little bit more than just a good player. When they drafted Ryan Zimmerman, they basically drafted him to be the face of their franchise for 2 years until they got into their ballpark. Now the ballpark will be the face of the franchise until they get good. But Ryan Zimmerman has been the face of the Nationals for 2 years. I think that was a huge factor in them drafting Ryan Zimmerman. And
Yeah.
you can debate the worthiness of that being a
To have
factor.
a guy who they drafted and who was almost immediately in the big leagues, I do think legitimized them to some degree.
I think it was a big deal for them. It
Yeah.
was kind of a big deal. So I think that's why they did it. So I think if they had the choice to do over again with those same circumstances, they would do it. Different circumstances, maybe they would do something different. It's
Yeah,
not like they couldn't use
I think
offense in the
right now you
outfield.
would say they would do it again. Maybe,
but
in
if
5 years
from now, if Ryan Braun's hitting, I'd put up a 1,400 ops against left-handed pitchers every year, and being league average the rest of the time, I think they'd probably say, "Well, we probably should have taken Ryan Braun." But point is, those are both really, really good players, and I think the consensus in the industry is that Alex Gordon will have a better career than those guys. When they were all amateurs, that was the consensus, and so Alex Gordon was picked second in that draft. Justin Upton first. The kind of the question in the middle of all that is Jeff Clement at three. Troy Tulowitzki went seven, not three. He was pretty darn good. And then Ricky Romero is not anywhere near the major leagues like all the other
That's
guys
the
are.
one
So
that really
that's
sort
the
of
head
jumps out
scratcher.
at you.
I'll turn that knife every time if I can in the side of Blue Jays fans, not out of my enmity for the Blue Jays, but out of just I just don't understand what that organization was thinking at that time. Anyway, that's enough. That's a great place to wrap it
I
up.
think
A
so.
dead end discussion. I Martin Luthered the this podcast. So for Will Lingo, I'm John Manuel. Until next time, so long, everybody.